where the sun never shines. You'll shiver when the cold wind blows. There's a grave in the pine where the sun never shines. There's a grave that's shaded with a pine.
Hello.
Hi.
And welcome.
Welcome.
To our adult slumber party. We have a new room to hang out in. It's fun.
Yeah, we are recording in a new space.
We are.
Nothing fun and exciting as far as
location or anything.
Yeah, well, as far as the listeners will hear, hopefully it'll sound wonderful.
Yes.
Nothing fun and exciting as far as you all should be concerned about.
No.
But for us.
Yeah.
Lots of fun and excitement.
It is. It's very comfortable, right?
Because this is a total like slumber party situation.
I'm here for it. But welcome to everyone else too.
Yes. Welcome all the queens, kings, and folks back to, what is this?
The Slay Queens podcast.
That is correct. Yes, it is. This is the Slay Queens podcast, the podcast where we do that thing. Ashley, what's that thing?
That thing where we take a deep dive into the dark side. You know what? Every time Sierra hears someone say the words deep dive, like we watch football and someone says, oh, it was a deep dive. Like every time she hears it, she's like, huh?
I actually, to be perfectly honest, didn't realize that that was the term people used quite so often until we started
either.
Doing this podcast.
No, I don't think I've ever used that term until now, but it's perfect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and now I feel like I hear it everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we should really do something about that. I feel like we're being a little bit generic by using that term, but I think we're committed to it at this point.
No, but I think it just goes. It just fits.
It just fits.
If it fits, I sit.
Is it hip and trendy and what all the kids are doing these days?
I guess so.
That's what the kids are saying.
I just turned old, so.
Oh, well, I mean, I've been old for a little while,
okay.
Let's move on from that subject, shall we?
Let's do the next thing on this list.
The next thing on the list is we will jump into the rainbow star. Rainbow because we're queer, star because we're giving shout outs, thank yous, making announcements or acknowledgments, and giving recommendations. I will start those if you'd like.
Yes, go for it.
Sounds good. First and foremost, shout outs for the Twitter love. Several podcasts, but I want to make a point to mention them all by name because we would hope that you would go out and support these other podcasts and these great shows. For the first A Bite Of podcast, of course, Reverie True Crime podcast, our friend Paige over there. She's always amazing. One Woman's Opinion podcast. Riddle Me That, True Crime Podcast, the Aaron It Out Podcast, the You Didn't Let Me Finish Podcast, Bitchin' Boutique Podcast, Forza Crowd Podcast, Beyond the Rainbow Podcast, specifically that one for LGBTQIA plus listeners, Family Plot Podcast, Oklahoma Side, which is my current favorite podcast name. Mm-hmm. I just love it. Twisted and Uncorked podcast, and a couple of screen names. First and foremost, Aurora over at Murder, Murder News. Jamal from both the Thanks for Coming podcast and the Treble Treble podcast. And screen name D_Ghostwriter and @NotActuallyTan for the Twitter love. Again, thank you. Thank you all so much. We sincerely appreciate it. And we hope to be able to return those love and affections in any way that we can.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. So, continuing the thank yous.
Yeah.
We got some lovely 5-star rates and reviews on Apple Podcasts. So I would like to acknowledge those people. I pray to God or whatever deity you so choose that I am saying this screen name correctly because I do not want to be offensive to anyone. But I swear that it is Fat Baby 13.
Yeah, I love it.
I even made Ashley take a look at it just so...
Yeah. I concur.
Yeah. And page 87, we got some lovely 5-star rates and reviews from those two individuals. And we also got a lovely 5-star rate and review from Lydia, who is the proprietor or the creator of the One Woman's Opinion podcast, which we, of course, also shout out in our shout outs.
Yes.
And then you have a specific thank you, a birthday thank you.
I have two, actually. Birthday, that would be a long list, but specifically our friend Chloe. Thank you for the wine money. It was for me and Wayne.
Yes.
It was put to good use, of course.
Extremely good use, yes.
Yeah, I think like 5 bottles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't just us, so like, that's fine. It was a gathering of 10 people or less with 6 feet distance.
Absolutely. And no one was symptomatic of any sort of illness.
That's
right. No one had traveled outside of the country in the last 14 days.
Yes, but thank you, because that was just super sweet.
It was
very thoughtful, and we appreciated it. I definitely appreciate it. Also, too, my story was a listener recommendation.
Oh, that's right. You mentioned that.
Her name is Beth Wilson, which I didn't ask ahead of time. So if I'll ask her after this, and if she doesn't want her name in there, then we'll just edit that out. But it was a friend of the Queen's. So thank you, Beth. And I'm actually really excited about this because it kind of comes on the heels of something that I've mentioned in a previous episode. So I think that's why she reached out.
Great.
Yeah.
As far as acknowledgements or announcements, I don't really have anything other than maybe the Patreon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep an eye out for some new things coming to the Patreon. Just keep an eye on the social medias. We'll make you well informed when it's officially happening. But please keep your eyes peeled for that.
Eyes peeled.
And as far as recommendations, I would just recommend all of the above mentioned podcasts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're all amazing. They all do great work. And we're all just trying to creatively put ourselves out there.
Yeah.
So please support them, love them, and give them all the good vibes and good feelings.
Yes, please.
All right. Anything else?
No, I honestly don't think. I think that's about it.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and let Ashley tell us a titillating story.
A titillating story.
And we're back.
And we're back again.
Back again. All right, Ashley, what do you have for us today?
I guess we're just going to call it the story or the murder of Kitty Genovese, but it has a lot of things that come along with it. It's like one of these stories that I feel like a lot of people have heard or heard of, but they didn't realize probably that she was a lesbian.
Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, we talked about this case when it was originally suggested by the listener, and you said that you were going to cover it, and I think said to you at the time, I was like, I'm somewhat familiar with this case.
Yeah.
I think all, like, true crime aficionados are somewhat familiar with this case, but I had no clue that there was any sort of, like, LGBTQIA element, so I'm excited to hear this.
Exactly. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that she was a lesbian, because I couldn't really find either way, but she had a girlfriend at the time of this, so we know that she's family.
Yeah, she was at least part of the queer community.
All right, so the way that I'm going to kind of start this is basically the question of, what is Kitty Genovese syndrome? The bystander effect is also known sometimes as the syndrome after Kitty Genovese, whose 1964 murder in Queens, New York, sparked social psychologists to study the bystander effect. 28-year-old Kitty Genovese was, I didn't realize how redundant that was when I wrote it,
it's okay.
Was coming home from her work at a bar around 3 a.m. on March 13th, 1964, when she was stabbed outside the apartment building across the street from where she lived in an apartment above a row of shops in Austin Street in the Kew Gardens neighborhood of Queens in New York City. 2 weeks after the murder, the New York Times published an article claiming that 38 witnesses saw or heard the attack, and that none of them called the police or came to her aid. The incident prompted inquiries into what became known as the bystander effect, or, quote, Genovese syndrome, and the murder became a staple of U.S. psychology textbooks for the next four decades. However, researchers have since uncovered major inaccuracies in the New York Times article, which, I mean, obviously, that's what they say about everything. It changes over however many years, right?
It's that
What's that
game that you played, like, at summer camp, like telephone thing, where
exactly
the story changes a little bit, especially when you consider that this was how long ago? 40, 50 years ago?
At least 50 years ago, right? So, where was I? Reporters at a competing news organization discovered in 1964 that the article was inconsistent with the facts, but they were unwilling at the time to challenge the New York Times editor, Abe Rosenthal. In 2007, an article in The American Psychologist found, quote, no evidence for the presence of 38 witnesses, or that witnesses observed the murder, or that witnesses remained inactive, end quote. In 2016, The New York Times called its own reporting, quote, flawed, stating that the original story grossly exaggerated the number of witnesses and what they had perceived, which, whatever, I hate to take that away now. It's still a great story, but, like, who knows if that's even?
Yeah.
Who knows why people are changing the story now? You don't know that that's fact, so still a tragic story. Winston Mosley, a 29-year-old Manhattan native, was arrested during a house burglary 6 days after the murder. While in custody, he confessed to killing Genovese. At his trial, Mosley was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death. This sentence was later commuted to life imprisonment, which is also frustrating. He's got a an interesting story too, once we get down to that like nitty gritty. So I kind of go back and go like, okay, so who is Kitty? She was Catherine Susan Genovese, born July 7th, 1935 in Brooklyn, New York City, the eldest of five children of an Italian-American parents, Rachel and Vincent. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that middle name. Italian AF. She was raised Catholic, living in a brownstone home at 29 St. John's Place in Park Slope, a Western Brooklyn neighborhood populated mainly by families of Italian and Irish heritage. In her teenage years, she attended the all-girl Prospect High School, where she was recalled as being self-assured beyond her years and having a sunny disposition. After her mother witnessed a murder, her family moved to New Canaan, Connecticut in 1954, while Genovese, who had recently graduated from high school, remained in Brooklyn with her grandparents to prepare for her upcoming marriage. Later that year, the couple wed, but the marriage was annulled near the end of 1954. After moving into an apartment in Brooklyn, Genovese worked in clerical jobs, which she found unappealing. By the late 1950s, she accepted a position as a bartender. In August 1961, she was briefly arrested for bookmaking, as she had been taking bets on horse races for bar patrons. She and her friend D, Italian last name, I'm not even going to try, were fined $50 each, and she lost her job. I'm like, I didn't know she was such a badass.
Well, I had serious questions when you said that she was arrested for bookmaking. I'm like, yeah. What kind of oppressive bullshit is this? But then as like, you further explained, she was working as a bookie, essentially, yep. Is what you mean. Yep. Okay.
I thought the same thing. I'm like, oh, yeah. She's not allowed to write? I mean, not that seems very 20s, not 50s, but okay.
Maybe. But I have to agree. Sounds like she was a badass. And I'm getting some like AOC feels.
Yes,
with like
right?
Brooklyn and being like, I don't want to be a secretary. I'm going to be a bartender.
Like, I have this good job, but like, I'm bored. I need to make like have some fun.
For sure.
She held another bartending position at Ev's 11th Hour Bar on Jamaica Avenue and 193rd Street in Hollis, Queens, and was soon managing the bar on behalf of its absentee owner. By working double shifts, she was able to save money, which she intended to use to open an Italian restaurant. She shared her apartment at 8270 Austin Street with her girlfriend, Marianne Ziolanco, whom she met in 1963. So there it is, right?
There it is.
If you had questions. Okay, so then I kind of go, we're going to go back to like the night of the attack. So what had happened was at approximately 2:30 a.m. on March 13th, 64, Genovese left the bar where she worked and began driving home in her red Fiat. While waiting for a traffic light to change on Hoover Avenue, she was spotted by Winston Mosley, who was sitting in a parked car. Genovese arrived home around 3:15 and parked her car in the Kew Gardens Long Island Railroad Station parking lot. About 100 feet from her apartment door, in an alleyway at the rear of the building, as she walked towards the apartment complex, Mosley, who had followed her home, exited his vehicle, which he had parked at the corner bus stop on Austin Street. Armed with a hunting knife, he approached Genovese, which is freaking terrifying already.
No, that's horrific.
Like, all of that, you know he's been watching her. He's got a hunting knife.
And she has to know that he's there. You know what I mean? Like, maybe
you don't not know that.
Not immediately, but it's what, 3 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. The streets are empty.
You're walking that.
Yeah, you're walking that 100 feet from wherever it is you parked your vehicle to the door. You know that like creepy, ominous feeling, and or you hear his footsteps. You know someone's approaching. And imagine the horror to turn around and see this person's carrying a fucking hunting knife.
Oh, like, it's just God. The fact that it's even a person, but, like, this guy's got a knife, man.
This poor woman.
So Genovese ran toward the front of the building, and Mosley ran after her, overtook her, stabbed her twice in the back. She screamed, "Oh, my God, he stabbed me. Help me." Several neighbors heard her cry, but only a few of them recognized the sound as a cry for help. When Robert Moser...
He stabbed me, right? Wait, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, it's one thing for, like, just a random person to be screaming in the middle of the night. I understand, especially if you live in a highly populated area like New York, Brooklyn, et cetera, et cetera. But she's literally screaming, "Oh, my God, he's stabbing me. And no one thought that was a cry for help?
No.
Oh, my God.
But it gets even better because when Robert Moser, one of the neighbors, shouted at the attacker, "Let that girl alone." Mosley ran away and Genevieve slowly made her way to the rear entrance of the building, seriously injured and out of view of any witnesses. What? Let that girl alone.
Let that girl alone.
Oh my gosh. What? I don't know why I said it in like an accent like he was from Texas.
I guess he's a big man because
he must have been scary enough.
He actually said something as opposed to
doing nothing.
Yeah.
So then witnesses saw Mosley enter his car, drive away, and return 10 minutes later. Shadowing his face with a wide-brimmed hat, he systematically searched the parking lot, the train station, the apartment complex, eventually finding Genevieve, who was barely conscious and lying in a hallway at the back of the building where a locked door had prevented her from going inside. Out of the view of the street and of those who may have heard or seen any sign of the initial attack, Mosley stabbed Genevieve several more times before raping her.
Oh my God.
Stealing $49 from her. And running away again. Hold on. Oh my God, I know.
Oh, it's so terrible.
The attack spanned approximately half an hour, and knife wounds in Genevieve's hands suggested that she attempted to defend herself from him. Oh, like, that's just like, I just picture this person like by a door that's just like, God, I hope somebody finds me because I can't go anywhere. And then all of a sudden he's back.
Lying like, there thinking, I survived this terrible attack. I survived. I just have to hang on long enough for someone to help.
Right.
And then he shows back up. Oh my God.
I know. Ugh, horrifying. Horrifying. A neighbor and close friend, Sophia Farrar, found her shortly after and held her in her arms, which is just heartbreaking too. These sinuses, I swear it's not the coronavirus.
It's living in the Ohio River Valley.
It really is. Gosh, it's fall time, man.
Yeah.
Okay. So records of the earliest calls to police are unclear and were not given a high priority. The incident occurred 4 years before New York City implemented the 911 emergency call system. So there was no, and that's another thing about this case that I'll mention later is they've said that this is one of the reasons why 911 exists mm-hmm. is because of stories like this.
Yeah. And that's why I was somewhat familiar with this story because I worked in 911 previously and we learn a little bit of history of the system and whatnot. And I know a handful of facts about this because of that reason. So please continue.
Well, no. And the one reason that I remembered that I like knew this story was because I know I've heard, I don't know what other podcast, but I know I've heard another podcast tell this story a long time ago. And as I'm like reading the story again, I'm like, oh, I know this story. Like, I know this.
It's a classic case.
It is.
I think any podcast that's been around for quite some time that specializes in true crime, at least.
Has, definitely know about it.
Yeah, they know about it.
Okay. So one witness said his father called the police after the initial attack and reported that a woman was, quote, beat up, but got up and was staggering around. So, like, that's not really an accurate description.
Not so accurate, yeah.
A few minutes after the attack, another witness, Carl Ross, called two friends for advice on what to do. The second of whom called a third friend, who then called the police.
Oh my God, this is not funny. I'm not laughing.
No, it's like a stupidity. You
exactly.
can't believe it, right?
Exactly. I'm not laughing because this horrific thing happened to this poor woman. You're
like,
absolutely correct. I'm laughing at the stupidity of them being like, you know what?
What do you think I should do?
What do you think I should do, friend? Oh, I don't know. Let me call this other person.
Who calls
this
friend.
Other person? Exactly. I'm phoning a
what
friend.
What is this?
Let me use a lifeline. No, that's ridiculous.
I know. I know. Okay. The second of whom called a third friend. So the third friend called the police, who arrived at the scene within minutes of this call. Genevieve was picked up by an ambulance at 4:15 a.m. and died en route to the hospital. She was buried on March 16, 1964 in Lakeview Cemetery in New Canaan, Connecticut. Ugh, it's just so sad because you know that it could have been so... It's like when you watch a horror movie and someone like is getting away and then they slow down and you're like, don't slow down. Like,
exactly.
Don't slow down. And then...
Yeah.
Ugh.
And they stop and take the time to look behind them.
Don't do it.
You're like, don't do that. Just keep running.
You know, and you shouldn't be running up the front stairs when you should be running out the door or running up the stairs when you should be running out the front door. It's insulting.
Exactly. Sydney Prescott.
We do share a birthday. Okay. And then is my next... part. On March 19th, 1964, 6 days after the stabbing, Winston Mosley was arrested for suspected robbery, like we had mentioned before, in Queens after a television set was discovered in the trunk of his car, a white Chevrolet Corvair. That's crazy. Mosley's car was searched after a local man, Raul Cleary, became suspicious when he saw Mosley removing the television from a neighbor's house. He questioned Mosley, who claimed to be a removal worker. However, after consulting with another neighbor, Jack Brown, who confirmed that the homeowners were not moving, Cleary called the police. Brown disabled Mosley's car to ensure he could not get away before the police arrived, which is genius. Never thought of that before.
I mean, it is, but...
You're not supposed to do that. I mean, people back then probably could get away with things like that. We have laws against it now. But a detective recalled that a white car had been reported by some of the witnesses to Genevieve's murder, and he informed detectives Carol and Sang. During questioning, Mosley admitted to the murder of Genevieve's and two other women, Annie Mae Johnson, who had been shot and burned to death in her apartment in South Ozone Park a few weeks earlier, which is where he'd stolen the television, I should add in, and a 15-year-old, Barbara Kralik, who had been killed in her parents' Springfield Gardens home in the previous July. So then I kind of have a little bit more about
him. So he's a serial killer, by definition.
He is. I mean, he's claiming to be anyways.
Oh, got it.
You know, that kind of thing.
Got it.
It could be like he knew the story, or maybe he really did it. You'll see. So about him and his imprisonment, really, is all I have left. Because he's an interesting character, a little bit. So Winston Mosley was born March 2nd, 1935, and was 29 years old at the time he murdered Genevieve's. He was from Ozone Park, Queens, and worked at Remington Rand as a tab operator, preparing the punched cards he used at that time for data storage for digital computers. He was married with three children and had no prior criminal record. While in custody, Mosley confessed to killing Genevieve's. He detailed the attack, corroborating the physical evidence at the scene. He said that his motive for the attack was simply to kill a woman, saying he preferred to kill women because, quote, they were easier and they didn't fight back. We've heard that before with, like, male sex workers and women, too.
Yeah, and we've heard that with people like Colin Ireland.
Yes.
People who said that they chose to specifically target submissive gay men who were looking,
men, yeah,
yeah, because they were easier targets and didn't fight back and whatnot.
Or the ones we've heard of with like older people.
Yeah.
So he stated that he got up around 2 a.m., leaving his wife asleep at home and drove to Queens to find a victim. Drove through Queens, I suppose. He saw Genevieve's on her way home and followed her to the parking lot before killing her. He also confessed to murdering and sexually assaulting two other women and committing between 30 and 40 burglaries, which is crazy if he's had no offenses. What is this guy doing? Was he Batman? Like, what? Subsequent psychiatric examinations suggested that Mosley was a necrophile too. So yeah, that
okay.
was, which, I mean, obviously we know that about him when it came to what he did with her.
Yeah.
An IQ test carried out after his arrest gave a score of 135. So he's not a complete...
No.
He's fine. He's there. He's with it. Mosley was charged with the murder of Genevieve's, but was not charged with the murder of the other two. For the police, a complicating factor was that another man, Alan Mitchell, had also confessed to the murder of Barbara, which I think was the 15-year-old. Mosley's trial began on June 8th, 1964, and was presided over by Judge J. Irwin Shapiro. Mosley initially pleaded not guilty, but his attorney later changed his plea to not guilty by reason of insanity. During his testimony, Mosley described the events on the night he murdered Genevieve's, along with the two other murders to which he had confessed and numerous other burglaries and rapes, like I mentioned. And the jury deliberated for 7 hours on all of those before returning a guilty verdict around 10:30 p.m. on June 11th. On June 15th, Mosley was sentenced to death for the murder of Genevieve's. When the jury foreman read the sentence, Mosley showed no emotion, while some spectators applauded and cheered. Shapiro added, "I don't believe in capital punishment, but when I see a monster like this, I wouldn't hesitate to pull the switch myself." On June 23rd, Mosley appeared as a defense witness in the trial of Alvin Mitchell for the murder of Barbara Kralik. After being granted immunity from prosecution, he testified that he had killed her. The trial produced a hung jury, but Mitchell was convicted in a second trial. So he literally like went and tried to take someone else's sentence, and they still just were like, no, we're gonna still kill this guy.
Okay.
I mean, it's interesting. I would like to know more why, but we only have so much time. On June 1st, 1967, the New York Court of Appeals found that Mosley should have been able to argue that he was medically insane at the sentencing hearing when the trial court found that he had been legally sane and the sentence was reduced to lifetime imprisonment. So we're just going back and forth between death and life.
Yeah, that doesn't really make any sort of sense to me.
It really doesn't. And I don't know what leg they have to stand on either, but it does get a little less complicated. He's just an interesting case, honestly. Because when you see how it ends up, on March 18th, 1968, he escaped from prison while being transported back from Meyer Memorial Hospital in Buffalo, New York, where he had undergone minor surgery for a self-inflicted injury. He hit the transporting correctional officer, stole his weapon, and fled to a nearby vacant house by Grand Island, New York. Couple Mr. and Mrs. Matthew Kaluaga, where he stayed undetected for 3 days. On March 21st, the Kaluagas went to check on the house where they encountered Mosley, who held them hostage for more than an hour, binding and gagging Matthew and raping Mrs. Kaluaga. He then took the couple's car and fled. Mosley traveled to Grand Island, where on March 22nd, he broke into another house and held a woman and her daughter hostage for 2 hours before releasing them unharmed. He surrendered to police shortly afterward and was charged with escape and kidnapping, to which he pled guilty. He was given 2 additional 15-year sentences to run concurrently with his life sentence. It seems like he just is like, if I'm going to prison, I'm going to prison as a serial killer. Like, I'm not going down for the death of one female that was like a thief in the night. Like, I wanted to do more.
Yeah, like he wants to go into prison as...
Wait, you just killed one chick? So did I.
Exactly. Like, you know? He wants to go into prison as badass a guy, and I do not think he's a badass.
No,
I think
it's disgusting.
He's a piece of shit. I think he's a sociopath, and...
It's insane.
I think he probably should have been... sentenced to death, but that's exactly what I was thinking, is that it almost seems like he had the mindset of, well, if I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison, like, I'm going to be a big man.
Go big or go home, right? So I only have a little bit more of this interesting character. He became eligible for parole in 1984. During his first parole hearing, he told the parole board that the notoriety he faced due to his crimes made him a victim, stating, "For a victim outside, it's a one-time or one-hour or one-minute affair. But for the person who's caught, it's forever."
You're kidding me. That's 3 gallons of bullshit and a 2 gallon bucket.
And that's a real laugh. Like, I'm really laughing.
I cannot stand people who commit these atrocious, disgusting, horrific crimes that then try and find a way to victimize themselves.
Or victim blame. Well, and we see that a decent amount too, but like the creative things that they say are the best part to me, because that's like, I mean, you're blatantly just saying like, oh, I'm a victim, you're not a victim. But there was one of the documentaries that I told people to watch. I won't say which one it is, so I don't give it away, but that's like how, like, they asked the kid. I mean, he's not a kid, obviously, but he's young. "Well, do you have any last words?" And he basically says, like, "I forgive you guys for the atrocities brought upon me." Mm. And I was like, you murdered a family. Anyways, we'll finish the rest of this. Okay. So after that, the same hearing, Mosley claimed he never intended to kill Genovese and that he considered her murder to be a mugging, because people do kill people when they mug them sometimes.
Wasn't his original story that he got
just wanted to kill someone?
I got out of my bed where I was laying, sleeping with my wife whilst my children were asleep in their beds, and drove across town to find someone to kill.
Yes.
I understood that correctly?
No, yes.
Okay, all right, just making sure.
But now he's like, no, it does happen sometimes, whatever. The board denied his request for parole. He returned for a parole hearing March 13, 2008, the 44th anniversary of Genovese's murder. He continued to show little remorse for Genovese's murder, and parole was again denied. Genovese's brother, Vincent, was at the 2008 hearing, and he said, "This brings back what happened to her, and the whole family remembers," kind of thing. And it was this really cute little quote that I saw. So he was denied, Mosley was denied parole for an 18th time in November 2015, and he died in prison on March 28th. 2016, at the age of 81, he had served 52 years, making him one of the longest serving inmates in the New York State prison system.
Good.
Which Doesn't that just make you happy to hear that?
It absolutely does. If
18 times trying to get out, 52 years in.
If they didn't do anything else right, they kept his ass in jail for 50 plus years and denied him 18 different opportunities to get out. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
Thank you. The only thing that I wanted to say was there was this, and New York City's WNYC, looking back in 2014, reported an iconic murder helped create the 911 system, which is like this article that you can look up on how they've tied these together kind of thing.
I think I've read that article.
Yeah.
That sounds, I think that's why I knew about this case.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And also, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't there a documentary or something that her brother actually participated in? I think there was.
There probably was, because there's like a couple like from the New York Daily like news reports of like clips and stuff. So I would probably think that. I mean, there's a long list of things you can watch about.
Honestly. I think it's not something that I've watched, but I think it's something that has been recommended to me by someone else.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And they mentioned specifically that her brother was...
It even says here that a PBS report wrote how papers and media outlets ran with the story, right? Mm-hmm. They also added nearly a dozen books. And when it came to film, mentioned James Solomon's film The Witness more than once.
Okay.
Which I guess I remember that movie, but I don't remember what happened in it.
I don't believe the movie that I'm thinking of is the same
movie. Maybe it's not. I feel like there's probably a lot of movies named that.
Yeah, because the one that I'm thinking of is like Kelly McGillis. Like,
yeah, that's what I'm Amish thinking of.
Amish family. Also a very good movie, but...
It's definitely not. I'm like, am I missing something there? Were they related?
How is there a correlation between the two?
Maybe I was just really stoned when I watched that. No.
Maybe she just really liked to wear black.
Yeah.
No.
That was a crazy, like that story was crazier than I thought it was going to be. Like, I feel like it's like a bunch of stories that I've heard before, but it's like one story. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, the thing that I'm most offended by that story is that people seemingly, from what I'm hearing, is that people seem to care more about their neighbor's television being stolen from their house than a poor woman being stabbed and raped and beaten and killed.
That's what got him caught.
In the street.
Yeah. His robberies are what got him caught when he'd already done something. And the thing is, like, people are so concerned with the fact that they misquoted how many people were around. You know what? Maybe the bystander effect isn't a thing, but it is. No, especially as now. Like, the way we've talked about it, the way people pull out their phones, like, no. Yeah. If it wasn't then, and it wasn't definitely a thing then, it definitely is now, and that's why we refer to it.
Yeah, and you know what? Who fucking cares?
Yeah.
38, 40 people.
It's a tragic story.
Okay, fine. 38 to 40 people, that's excessive. That's a lot. And that might not be the actual number of witnesses.
But if it was two people.
Exactly. Even if there were two people who stood by and did nothing, that's too many.
That's what I'm saying. Like, more than any people, whatever. Get out of here.
Absolutely.
Let's take a break.
Let's cool off. Let's cool off and take a break.
Hello. We're back.
Hello. We're back. I didn't want to say back again because I feel like I've already done that. I've already did that.
Redundant.
We've already did that. But I just enjoy doing it so much.
I know. Yeah. And it's still like your thing though. You just say it so much, but it like rolls off so much better than mine.
Well, I've practiced.
Yeah. That's
yeah. Right. Just like I practice my tongue pop. I'm really just practicing to be Alyssa Edwards.
I support it.
There we go. That's a good tongue pop.
See, remember when we've tried to, I can't do it.
The first one's always horrible for me, but then like...
You gotta get her going.
Yeah, I gotta get her going. Gotta get her nice and like looped up.
Yeah. So tell me what we're gonna talk about. How do we always do that?
I don't know. It's just the nature of our relationship, I suppose. Okay. So I do think it's interesting that you told us that story, which was very historical in a lot of ways, you know, like 911 system.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of how its inception and whatnot. So I do think that there are some historical elements to this case as well. They're not really similar in the people involved per se, but I think they're similar in the fact that there's some historical relevance. So
I appreciate that.
Today, I will be talking about two spirits. The murder of F.C. Martinez.
I'm actually excited about this now that I remember what you're going to be talking about.
There is a lot of really good information that I came across that I hope that I can share with you and with the listeners about two-spirit individuals that I didn't know before. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's really important as a member of the queer community or the LGBTQIA plus community to have a good understanding of these people. My sources were, I watched a short documentary. It was just like 10 minutes. I found it on YouTube. It was titled In the Life, The Murder of, and I'm not going to continue that statement because they use this person's dead name. So just know that you could probably find it easily on YouTube just by searching In the Life, The Murder of. Uh-huh. Sure. And the last name is Martinez, but I'm not going to use the first name.
Yeah.
Also, IHS.gov. Which is the Federal Health Program for American Indians and Alaskan Natives. It's their official website. I also got some information off of the WashingtonPost.com, also HuffPost.com, SFGate.com, and the Journal.com. And I know that sounds like a lot of sources, but there's not a ton of information.
You kind of have to
there.
Like pull from.
Yeah, from a lot of different sources just to get a little bit of information. Mm-hmm. All right. So I was going to start with kind of the more historical portion of the story. A lot of people might not be familiar. Like I said, I wasn't as familiar as I am now and probably not as knowledgeable as I should be. But for anybody who's curious, what is a two-spirit person or what is a two-spirit?
Yes.
Okay. Though the term two-spirit may often be included under the umbrella of the LGBTQ community, it does not simply mean a person who is Native American and or Alaskan Native that is also gay. Traditionally, Native American two-spirit people were male, female, or sometimes intersex individuals who combined activities of both men and women with traits unique to their status as a two-spirit person. In most tribes, they were considered neither men nor women, but rather they occupied a distinct gender status. According to an article on thenumenous.com, which was titled Five Genders, the Story of Native American Two-Spirits, prior to Christian intervention, so thanks.
Yeah.
Christian church.
Right.
Prior to the Christian intervention, fluid gender identities of the Native American Two-Spirits were seen as a gift from the gods. For Native Americans, there was no set of rules that men or women had to abide by in order to be fully accepted as a member of their tribe. In fact,
I'm already loving this.
Yeah, no, this is great information, and it's a great culture.
I really, really had no idea, honestly.
In fact, people who had both male and female characteristics were viewed as gifted by nature and therefore able to see both sides of everything.
I love that.
I love that. It warms my heart to think there was ever a culture that embraced gender
fluidity or androgyny
in that really. Way. Yeah. Elevated it. Didn't just accept it.
Well, I do in my mind. I think it's the best thing ever. But, you know, the general public, unfortunately.
Well, that's...
Christian
interference. Influence. According to historical...
Interference and influence are both the same. It's the same thing when it comes to
this. At least in this case.
Yeah.
According to historical publications, all Native communities acknowledge the following gender roles. Female, male, two-spirit female, two-spirit male, and transgender. So that's a total of five.
Okay, gotcha.
Each tribe had their own specific term to describe these individuals. The Navajo term used to describe their two-spirit population. I'm sorry, I can't speak today. And forgive me, I did go into some research as to the correct pronunciation of this, mm-hmm. but I still may get it wrong.
It's all right.
The Navajo term for two-spirit people was Nadlehe, which literally translates as one who is transformed. And again, it wasn't until Europeans took over North America that natives adopted the ideas of air quotes, traditional gender roles. The two-spirit culture of Native Americans were one of the first things that Europeans worked to destroy and cover up. As a result, Native Americans were forced to dress and act according to the newly designated gender roles. So essentially, Europeans came in with the Christian church and said, no,
literally,
this doesn't work
John
for
Smith.
Us.
And also, like, rule number 475, why I will homeschool my children if I ever have them one day.
I think that is wise.
things like this. I mean, I feel it's sad that I'm learning this year how many things I'm like, oh God, I guess you weren't taught that in school, and definitely not this. I mean, Of course, they're covered up. Didn't happen.
Yeah.
It's not real.
That's not a real part of history. Fake news. Yeah. All right. So who was F.C. Martinez? I'm going to preface this information with the fact that in doing my research, I found that there was no real consistency in how people spoke or wrote of F.C. Martinez with regard to gender, gender identity, sexuality, preferred name, preferred pronouns, etc. That being said, we do know for a fact that this person self-identified as Two-Spirit. So for the purposes of my telling the story today, I'll be using gender-neutral pronouns. Additionally, in efforts not to deadname them, continue using the name FC, because I was able to find in more than one publication that this was their preferred name, and this was the name used by their friends and family. Admittedly, the use of gender-neutral pronouns is something that in the past I've kind of struggled with. Mm-hmm. So by all means, Ashley, if I do make a mistake while I'm telling the story, or even listeners, if I make a mistake, please correct me. I fully accept that. But know that if I do misgender this person while telling the story, sure, it was completely unintentional and it was completely accidental. All right, here we go. F.C. Martinez was born in Tuba City, Arizona on March 15th of 1985, the child of Fred C. Martinez Sr. and Pauline Mitchell. They were raised in a remote little city on the Colorado Plains named Cortez, which is located approximately 300 miles southwest of Denver. It's near the borders of Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. So kind of...
Wow, the, wherever that is, I want to go there.
Yeah, kind of in the like the pocket or the armpit of that state.
Yeah.
FC loved making music and playing the clarinet. They also enjoyed listening to music. Specifically Beyonce, of course, because Slay Little Queen. They loved dancing and drew satisfaction from creating artwork. FC attended Montezuma Cortez High School, where they were open and proud of their Navajo ancestry and their identity as Natlehe, or a Two-Spirit Native American person. By the age of 16, FC often carried a purse, wore eye makeup, also a tissue stuffed bra under their t-shirts, and kept their dark hair curled and styled. As a result of this, FC endured taunts, snickers, and gay slurs from classmates, as well as the stares and whispers of strangers on the street. Robin Flores, FC's closest friend, recalls a, quote, gentle youth who masked their pain with a smile, often saying things like, no, no, it's fine, it's just words. Despite this strength, due to the harassment they endured, FC switched from regular high school classes to adult education courses, which I think probably means dropped out of traditional high school mm-hmm. to attend like GED program, yeah. high school equivalency, that sort of thing.
That's what I assume.
Yeah. Their home life, however, was less complicated. Living with a loving, supportive mother who embraced her child's identity as a Two-Spirit, and describing FC as, quote, a beautiful, wonderful, sweet child, an outspoken person who loved to laugh and make jokes and make friends, end quote. Adding that they were, quote, the most precious thing in my life.
Why do I just feel like the most fierce person ever, too? Just 16, looking amazing, just snatched all the time.
Absolutely. And despite the adversity and the struggles and the taunts and just the hate that they received on a day-to-day basis, said, you know what? I am going to be a fierce badass bitch.
I'm fine. Yeah, I'm good.
I'm fine. I'll endure it. Words cannot hurt me.
Yep.
So now let's talk about the crime. FC Martinez was last seen alive the night of June 16th, 2001. They attended the UTE, I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation, but that's what I'm going to say, Ute Mountain Roundup Rodeo. The exact details of what transpired that evening are not exactly known, but from what investigators piece together, this is where FC first met a man by the name of Sean Murphy. Murphy, an 18-year-old resident of nearby Farmington, New Mexico, was at a party that FC was also at a party that FC attended after the rodeo. Later, Murphy and a friend offered them a ride home because they were actually headed to a friend's apartment that was on the way to FC's home.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
The men reportedly dropped FC off on a dirt road near the trailer park where they lived before reaching their friend's apartment. So they said, hey, we're going to this party. I guess at some point FC said, well, that's right on the way home for me. They said, okay, well, we'll give you a ride, but they didn't drive FC to their like trailer specifically, they dropped them nearby said, you'll have
I'm
to
good
walk.
Here. I'll yeah. walk. Yeah.
You'll have to walk the rest of the way. Uh-huh. All right. So they dropped FC off and went on to their friend's apartment where I guess there was an after party happening. But shortly after, Murphy and FC would meet up again for reasons that remain unclear. After some unspecified interaction that, quote, resulted in Murphy's finding out that FC was gay, he chased them down into a rocky canyon just south of the city of Cortez called the Pits and smashed their head repeatedly with a large rock. Murphy ultimately claimed to have been too intoxicated at the time to provide any further details regarding the attack. Bystanders at the aforementioned friend's apartment, so the after party, would later report that on that evening, or on the evening in question, Murphy abruptly left the residence before returning approximately 20 minutes later, covered in blood, bragging that he had, quote, beaten up a fag, end quote.
Ugh, God.
Whether FC died instantaneously or slowly over hours or even days is unknown. Their body was discovered 5 days later, barely recognizable, decomposing in the summer heat. FC's mother, Pauline, would later go on record as saying that the police did not contact her regarding her child's death until June 25th, which was 4 days after the discovery of the body, despite a missing persons report having been filed.
Ugh.
And the fact that she had frequently been calling the police station to check on the status of the investigation.
You're kidding.
No, ma'am.
Why? That's so...
I agree. Okay, so what happened? On July 3rd of 2001, Sean Murphy was arrested for the murder of FC Martinez after police had received information that Murphy had been bragging to his friends that he had, quote, beaten that fag up.
That sounds pretty much about right. Yeah, that's not what I didn't expect it to be anything different, really.
Murphy did not provide police with motivation for the attack, but claimed that his intention was not to commit murder. Further claiming that when he left FC in the pits, he did not believe the injuries they had sustained were fatal, so he did not report it and did not call for help. So he said, yeah, I beat them up, but I didn't think it was that bad. So
it was fine.
I didn't report it to anybody, and I definitely didn't call for help. Murphy was charged with first-degree murder at trial, but later took a plea deal, pleading guilty to a second-degree murder charge. The plea held a sentence of 4 to 48 years in prison. Though many considered the death of FC Martinez a hate crime, it was not charged as such because at the time, the legal definition of a hate crime did not include crimes based on a victim's gender identity or gender expression. Federal legislation to extend the definition of hate crimes to include those based on sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability wasn't passed until 2009.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I said that one like a few episodes ago. And when I read that, I was like, is that true? And I had to make sure that it was true.
Yeah. Speaking of 2009, that same year, a documentary honoring the life and memory of FC, as well as offering a broader context of the two-spirit gender identity, was produced by PBS. The documentary is, of course, appropriately titled Two Spirits. And once again, adding serious insult to an already horrifically tragic situation. In May of 2018, at the age of 36, after having served only 17 years of his sentence, Sean Murphy was released from prison. So he gets to go on and live a full life in Greeley, Colorado, by the way, listeners. Sean Murphy in Greeley, Colorado.
Of course, he has to have like one of the most generic names. No offense to anybody named that, but it's like it's like being named Kyle Smith.
Yeah.
Like, let's find him.
That's why.
EA or H-A-W.
Yeah. S-H-U-N. S-H-A-U.
A-U. Oh, I forgot about that one. Sorry. See, your name's not even relevant to me. Yeah. Sean. I'm just
Shuan.
Shuan.
So he gets to go on and live a life while FC remains one of the youngest hate crime victims in our LGBTQIA plus community's history.
That's just, that's just horrifying. That's just so, so sad.
It's a really horrific story.
It is.
It was a shorter story because there's not a ton of information.
And that's
out
so
there.
Sad too. I knew that was why. I was even going to say, like, I wish there was more, but.
Now, I suppose I probably could have gotten a bit more information if I had watched the Two Spirit documentary, but I kind of didn't want I felt like if I did that, I might spoil it for myself a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know how, I don't know how you feel about it, but oftentimes I want to read the book before I watch the movie.
It depends on which case it is for me, honestly. And I definitely feel that way a lot of the times where I'm like, I feel like I would rather just read this and put a story together in my head. Because no matter what you watch, there's going to be a little bit of some kind of like bias. Yeah. Like where your mind's going to sway in a way.
Yeah, or some dramatization.
Sure. Yeah.
Or something.
That's kind of what I mean, the way that they depict it visually speaking versus like words certainly can have bias to them, but you can also read that. It's like text versus conversation.
Absolutely.
You know?
That is absolutely correct.
It's a very long way of saying that.
Yeah. That was a very eloquent way of saying it too.
Thank you.
But if any of the listeners would go out and watch the Two-Spirit documentary, again, it was made by PBS. In 2009, let us know what you think of it.
Yeah.
I'll probably watch it at some point.
PBS?
PBS.
That's funny that we tied it in at least there. They both had like PBS references to like where you could watch stuff. Yeah. There we go.
So I hope that honored the memory of F.C. Martinez. And I hope that it taught some of the listeners a little bit more about the two-spirit gender.
Yeah, I'm definitely like, I want to go read more now. I'm so intrigued.
And honestly, part of the reason I was so intrigued, I heard a podcast and I can't remember who because I listened to so many at this point. I heard a podcast say recently if they had to give advice to other podcasters or new podcasters. And I mean, we're still relatively new podcasters.
Oh, yeah.
It would be to let the stories choose you.
Yes. You say that. I always forget that.
Yeah. And so I'm a fan of Drag Race. I mean, shocker, I'm a homosexual male. I'm a fan of Drag Race. And I watched the season of Canada's Drag Race recently, and there was a participant in Canada's Drag Race who identified as a two-spirit individual.
Oh, I love this.
And I was just kind of one day thinking about that, and I had some questions. So I went in and started reading some things, and you know how you kind of go down a rabbit hole?
Oh, yeah.
And
I feel like it's what's going to happen to me now that I've heard this story.
And I found this tragic crime, but I thought, you know, hey, let the story choose you. Though this was a little bit of a shorter one, I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to share with people.
Well, I mean, mine chose me because someone sent it to me and I was like, that sounds awesome. And I love it. So that was great. That was perfect.
Yeah. And we love
I love a good suggestion.
Those are often my favorites as well.
Yeah.
So if you listeners have any suggestions for stories that you'd like to hear, please let us know.
Yes, please.
Let us know. You can dive into our DMs, either Twitter or Instagram. Our screen names are
Slay Queens Pod.
That's right. You can send us an email via Gmail, also at
Slay Queens Pod.
Yeah. Did you see how I segued just kind of into the ending?
That was good. Yeah. That was good.
Yeah. We thank you all so much for listening.
We do thank you.
We would also hope that if you are enjoying the show, that you will share it, like it, review it. Do all the good things. And
all the positive things.
All the positive things. And if you have anything constructive or anything that's not entirely positive,
That's fine too.
Just reach out in a respectful way. And we would like to address any concerns that you might have.
Just don't be mean. Yeah.
Yeah. We want to promote love and inclusion
and happiness.
And we want to
acceptance.
We want to build people up and not tear them down. And we would hope that if you're listening to this program, that would also be your goal.
Yes, please.
There's also something else. We want you to do something.
Go out
and go out and slay queens.
Yes, just at each other.
Just at each other.
I'm going away, but I won't come back on a lonesome railroad line. But I can't forget that sweet little girl who sleeps in the pines.